How many of you here have ever personally witnessed a total eclipse of the sun? To stand one day in the shadow of the moon is one of my humble goals in life. So far, however, life has thwarted me at every turn. Closest I ever came was about 23 years ago. On February 26th, 1979, a solar eclipse passed directly over the city of Seattle, Washington. I bought my bus ticket, found a place to stay, but in the end, I couldn't get the time off work. Well, anyone who lives in Seattle can tell you that the chances of seeing the sun in February are pretty slim. And sure enough, the skies over the city that day were completely overcast. I wouldn't have seen a thing. That work I couldn't get out of was my first job after college. A sales clerk in an old Radio Shack store in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts. On my very first day behind the counter, a delivery truck pulled up to the front of the store. They carried in a big carton upon which was printed the legend TRS-80. It was our first floor sample of the world's first mass-market microcomputer. The original TRS-80 Model 1 had a Z80 processor clocked at 1.7 megahertz, 4,000 bytes of memory, and a 64-character black-and-white text display. The only storage was a cassette recorder. All this could be yours for the low, low price of $599. Now, this store I was working at had seen better days. At one time, it had been near the center of a thriving commercial district. But like so many other New England cities, the advent of shopping malls had turned the once thriving center into a ghost town. Worcester's solution to this problem was decisive, to say the least. The city's elders apparently decided that if they couldn't beat them, they would join them. And so, 10 square blocks at the heart of the city were bulldozed into oblivion, destroying dozens of family businesses, including the site of a pharmacy once operated by my great-grandfather. In their place was erected a vast three-level shopping complex, complete with cinemas and a food court. When the dust settled, only a few forlorn blocks of the old Worcester remained standing. My Radio Shack store was in one of those blocks. Then, to add insult to injury, Radio Shack opened a brand new location inside the shopping center, less than 500 feet from our store. So now patrons had a choice between a clean, well-lighted establishment with uniform security and acres of free, convenient parking, or a shadowy hole in a seedy office building next to an adult movie theater. Consequently, I had plenty of time to fool around with the computer. I taught myself basic programming, then I learned Z80 assembly, both, of course, so that I could write games. I also created self-running animated demos, which ran all night in the store window for the edification of the winos who peed in our doorway. Strangely enough, the few customers we had didn't seem to be interested in our new computer, even after the 16K memory upgrade. In fact, most of the people who set off the buzzer in the front weren't there to buy anything at all. They were there to exploit a free promotion which has been the bane of Radio Shack employees for more than 30 years. The damned Battery of the Month Club. The idea of this promotion is simple. Customers get a little red card upon which is printed a square for each month. 12 times a year, the lucky sales clerk gets to punch out a square and give the customer one brand new AAA, AA, CD, or 9-volt battery. Of course, customers aren't allowed to choose just any grade of battery. At the time, Radio Shack offered three different levels of battery excellence. First were the alkalines, powerful, long-lasting, and expensive, hanging behind the counter like prescription drugs in gold-embossed blister packs. These were most certainly not available in the Battery of the Month Club. Next were the high-end lead batteries, sturdy, dependable batteries, moderately priced, prominently displayed near the front of the store. These were also not available through the Battery of the Month Club. Finally, at the bottom of the barrel were the standard lead batteries. These were literally piled in barrels, cunningly located way at the back of the store, in a dark corner near the TV antenna accessories. Remember TV antennas? Customers who came in looking for their Battery of the Month had to walk the entire length of the premises, past the CB radios and the stereo headphones and the radio control racing cars, in order to select their free, cheap battery. Nothing would stop them. On the first day of every month, like clockwork, these customers came in waving those damn little red cards. I would look up from my programming and wave them to the back of a store. Didn't matter that the batteries were worth only 29 cents. It didn't matter that half of them were already dead. They came, they grabbed, and as far as I can remember, not one of them ever paid for a goddamn thing. Oh, I was such a crappy salesman. I was young and foolish. I thought my education in game design was happening at the keyboard. I almost missed the lesson coming right through the front door. Fortunately, I wasn't the only person fooling around with games on micros at the time. All over the country, people like me were experimenting. Scott Adams was coding what would soon become the world's first commercial adventure game. Remember adventure games? My future employer, Infocom, was being founded, along with other legendary companies like Online Systems, Sirius, Personal Software, and SSI. Those were exciting times. Teenagers were making fortunes. Games were cheap and easy to build. The slate was clean. But in 1979, the biggest news in gaming had nothing to do with computers. On the morning of the autumn equinox, September the 20th that year, a new children's book appeared in the stores of Great Britain. This little picture book was rather peculiar. It consisted of 15 meticulously detailed color paintings illustrating a slight, whimsical tale about a rabbit delivering a jewel to the moon. On the back jacket of this book was a color photograph of a real jewel shaped like a running rabbit, 5 inches long, fashioned of 18-karat gold, suspended with ornaments and bells, together with a sun and moon of blue quartz. According to the blurb underneath, this very jewel had been buried somewhere in England. Clues pointing to its location were concealed in the text and pictures of the book. The treasure would belong to whoever found it first. The book was called Masquerade. It was created by an eccentric little man with divergent eyes and a talent for mischief named Kit Williams. Within days, the first printing sold out, and the empire that never sleeps found itself in the grip of rabbit fever. Excited readers attacked the paintings with rulers, compasses, and protractors. Magazine articles and TV specials dissected the clues, floated the theories, and followed with keen delight the reckless exploits of the fanatics. One obscure park, unfortunately known by the nickname Rabbit Hill, was so riddled with holes excavated by misguided treasure seekers that the authorities had to erect signs assuring the public that no gold rabbits were to be found there. Some hunters ended up seeking psychological counseling for their obsession. The craze leapt over the Atlantic Ocean and invaded America, France, Italy, and Germany. It sold over 1 million copies in less than a month, a record unrivaled by any other children's title until the advent of Harry Potter. Over 150,000 copies were sold in foreign translations, including 80,000 copies in Japanese, despite the fact that the treasure could only be found by using the clues in English. It didn't matter that the masquerade jewel was worth only a few thousand dollars. Many treasure seekers spent far more than that in their months of travel and excavation. It was the thrill of the chase, the possibility of being the one. Treasure hunts, secret messages, and hidden things seem to exert an irresistible appeal. They're fun to look for and talk about. And this fact of human psychology has been exploited in computer games since the very earliest days. It finds expression in the hidden surprises we call Easter eggs. Atari's Steve Wright is credited with coining that term in the first issue of Electronic Gaming magazine. And the first Easter egg in a commercial adventure game, a commercial computer game, appeared in an early Atari 2600 cartridge called, simply enough, Adventure. By a sequence of unlikely movements and obscure manipulations, players could discover a secret room where the words, "Created by Warren Robinet," appeared in flashing letters. Over the decades, Easter eggs and their evil twin, cheat codes, have become an industry within an industry. Entire magazines and websites are devoted to their carefully orchestrated discovery and dissemination. They're part of our toolkit, our basic vocabulary, the language of computer game design. Well, we computer gamers may have been the first to refer to our hidden surprises as Easter eggs, but we certainly were not the first to use them. Painters, composers, and artists of every discipline have been hiding stuff in their works for centuries. The recent advent of VCRs and Laserdisc players with freeze frame capability has exposed decades of secret Disney erotica. Thomas Kincaid, the self-appointed painter of light, amuses himself by hiding the letter N in his works. A number beside his signature indicates how many N's are hidden in each painting. Picasso, Dali, Raphael, Poussin, and dozens of other classic painters concealed all kinds of stuff in their paintings. A favorite trick was to hide portraits of themselves, their family, friends, and fellow artists in crowd scenes. El Greco, the painter, loved dogs, but the Catholic Church forbid him from including them in any of his sacred paintings. So he hid them, usually in the outlines of celestial clouds. The composer Dmitri Shostakovich chafed under the political censorship imposed by the Soviet Ministry of Culture. His symphonies and chamber works are loaded with hidden signatures and subversive subtexts which, had they ever been discovered by the authorities, would have sent him to Siberia. Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, is filled with musical allusions to the rituals of the Freemasons, an ancient secret society of which he and his mentor Haydn were both members. But the most famous purveyor of musical Easter eggs is that champion of the Baroque, the ultimate nerd, Johann Sebastian Bach. Bach was a student of gematria, the art of assigning numeric letters, values, to letters of the alphabet. A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3, etc. By comparing, sequencing, or otherwise manipulating these numbers, secret messages can be concealed. Bach took particular delight in the geometrical number 14 and also 41. 14 is the sum of the initials of his last name, B equals 2, A equals 1, C equals 3, and H equals 8. 41 is the sum of his expanded initials, J.S. Bach. These two numbers show up again and again all throughout Bach's work. One of the better known examples is the setting of the chorale "Vor deinem Throne," before thy throne. The first line of this melody contains exactly 14 notes, and the entire melody from start to finish contains 41. Another of Bach's favorite games was the puzzle canon. A canon, C-A-N-O-N, is a melody that sounds good when you play it on top of itself, a little bit out of sync. Frère Jacques and Row, Row, Row Your Boat are familiar examples of simple two-voice canons. But a canon can employ any number of voices, and you don't have to play each voice the same way either. You can change the octave, transpose the key, invert the pitch, play it backwards, or any combination of the above. Finding melodies that make good multi-voice canons is a fussy and difficult art, of which Bach was an undisputed master. Now, in a puzzle canon, the composer specifies the basic melody and the number of voices, but not the relationship of the voices. The student has to figure out the position and key of each voice and whether to perform them inverted or backwards. Bach wrote quite a number of these puzzle canons. The most famous, BWV 1076, is part of a fascinating story. One of Bach's students was a fellow by the name of Lorenz Misler, founder of a group called the Society of Musical Science. This elite, invitation-only institution devoted itself to the study of Pythagorean philosophy and the union of music and mathematics. Its distinguished membership reads like a who's who of famous composers, including Handel, Telemann, and eventually Mozart. Applicants for membership in this society were required to submit an original oil portrait of themselves, along with a specimen of original music. With nerdly efficiency, society member number 14 decided to combine these admission requirements into a single work. He sat for a portrait with Elias Hausmann, official artist of the court of Dresden. This portrait, which now hangs in the gallery of the town hall at Leipzig, is the only indisputably authentic image of Bach known to exist. The Hausmann portrait shows Bach dressed in a formal coat with exactly 14 buttons. In his hand is a sheet of music paper upon which is written a puzzle canon for six simultaneous voices. In 1974, a manuscript was discovered which proved that this canon was the 13th in a series of exactly 14 puzzle canons, based on the ground theme of the famous Goldberg Variations. As if these musical gyrations were not enough, Bach liked to hide messages in his compositions by assigning notes to the letters. His initials BACH correspond to the pitch sequence B flat, A, C, B natural in German letter notation. This theme, BACH, makes its most memorable appearance in the last bars of his final composition, heard here, The Art of Fugue, published soon after his death in 1750. The word fugue comes from the Latin word fuga, which means flight, as in running away. So the Art of Fugue is the art of flight, the art of taking a tune and running with it. Bach wrote hundreds of fugues, but none as sublime as this sequence of 14. In the last and most complicated fugue in the series, the first and second sections develop normally. Then there occurs a brief sequence of notes, which is physically impossible for a single keyboard player to perform. This is followed by the BACH signature, and suddenly, without any warning or structural justification whatsoever, the fugue stops, dead in its tracks. One of the composer's 20 children, his son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, claimed that Bach died moments after those last four notes were written. Until recently, the Easter eggs in Bach's music were a pleasant obscurity, known chiefly to professors and students of Baroque music. In just the past few weeks, however, this aspect of Bach's music has quite unexpectedly captured the attention of the entire classical music industry. Because sitting near the top of the classical music charts, as I speak, is a compact disc on the ECM label called Mortimer. It is performed by the Hilliard Choral Ensemble, together with a talented but until now little-known violinist, Christoph Popen. The music on this CD is based on a gematriacal analysis of Bach's Partita in D minor for solo violin. This analysis by German professor Helga Thone assigns numeric values to the duration of the notes, the number of bars, and the letter notation of the partita. In doing so, the professor claims to have discovered the complete text of several liturgical church ceremonies encoded in the notes. The CD presents these hidden texts superimposed over the original music. The result is strangely melancholy, dark, haunting, and very, very popular. Quite a few music critics have attacked this disc. They don't buy Professor Thone's analysis. They dismiss it as a combination of numerology and canny marketing. Their caution is certainly not without basis. Numerology is a slippery slope down which many a fine brain has slid to its doom. Allow me to offer an amusing example from my own experience. Back in the 90s, before the internet took off, one of the more popular bulletin board systems was an online service called Prodigy. I bought an account on Prodigy so I could join a fraternal interest group and gossip with distinguished brethren from around the country. One day, a stranger appeared on our bulletin board. Right away, we knew we were in trouble. This fellow, whose name was Gary, began spouting all kinds of nonsense about worldwide conspiracies, secret societies, devil worship, and that sort of thing. Well, first we tried to be polite. We questioned his sources, corrected his histories, logically refuted his claims, and tried to behave in a reasonably civilized manner. But instead of soothing him, our attention only made him worse. His conspiratorial warnings became urgent, approaching hysteria. He began to threaten people who disagreed with him. To coin a phrase, Gary went all uppercase. But his most urgent apocalyptic warnings weren't about the gays, the Jews, the Rockefellers, or the Illuminati. According to Gary, the greatest enemy of mankind is Santa Claus. Gary claimed to possess a numeric formula that proved, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Santa Claus is the avatar of the Antichrist. Intrigued, we pleaded with Gary to reveal his formula. In doing so, we walked right into his trap. We should have known he had a book to sell. Well, I fell for it. I sent him the $15, and less than a week later, the book arrived. Above an ominous photograph of the Washington Monument at night, in big block letters, 666, the final warning. Inside this privately printed 494-page monster, Gary reveals a simple geometrical formula which he claims was developed by the ancient Sumerians. This formula assigns successive products of six to each letter of the alphabet, the English alphabet. A equals 6, B equals 12, C equals 18, you get the idea. Imagine my dismay when I apply this ancient formula to the name Santa Claus and obtain the blasphemous number 666, the biblical number of the beast. I went on Prodigy and reported to the stunned members of our interest group that Gary was right after all. There could be no doubt that according to the unimpeachable wisdom of the ancient Sumerians, Santa Claus was the Antichrist. I then went on to point out several other names and phrases which, when submitted to Gary's formula, produced the sum 666. Words and names like computer, New York, New Mexico. I even posted a small PC program written in C that fellow investigators could use to test the formula for themselves. I still have a copy if you want it. Soon the bulletin board was filled with embarrassing discoveries. It added up to the hateful sum. Well, Gary left us alone after that. And I got our $15 worth. Well, Gary is hardly the first person to connect secret codes to the apocalypse. People have been looking for Easter eggs in the Holy Bible for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Hebrew mystical tradition of Kabbalah can be described as a gematrical meditation on the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. The advent of computers has made the application of numerology to the Bible fast and efficient. The latest spate of Bible searching was instigated by a book published in 1998 by Michael Drosnin, a former Wall Street Journal reporter. His book, The Bible Code, applied a skip cipher in which every nth character in a text is combined to form a message. By applying his skip cipher to the Hebrew text of the Pentateuch, Drosnin claimed to have discovered predictions of World War II, the Holocaust, Hiroshima, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and both Kennedys, the moon landing, Watergate, Oklahoma City bombing, election of Bill Clinton, the death of Princess Di, and the comet hitting Jupiter. He also found predictions of a giant earthquake in L.A., a meteor hitting the Earth, and nuclear Armageddon, all scheduled to occur before the end of this decade. The Bible Code spent several weeks on the bestseller lists, spawning several sequels and dozens of imitators. Yes, indeed, the Bible has certainly attracted its share of crackpots. But for the real, hardcore egg hunters, nothing can rival the ingenuity, the tenacious scholarship, the stubborn zeal of those who seek the answer to the ultimate literary enigma. A poisonous question that has squandered fortunes, destroyed careers, and driven healthy, intelligent scholars to the brink of madness and beyond. Who wrote Shakespeare? The essays and books devoted to the Shakespeare authorship problem are sufficient to fill a very large library. Several such libraries actually exist. Not even a day-long tutorial, much less an hour-long lecture, can begin to do justice to this complex, bizarre, and dangerously tantalizing story. Nevertheless, for the uninitiated, I will attempt to summarize the issue in a few paragraphs. The indisputed facts of Shakespeare's life and career could be scribbled on the back of a cocktail napkin. We know for a fact that a man named William Shakespeare was born in 1564 in or around the village of Stratford-upon-Avon. We know for a fact that he had a wife and at least three children. We know he bought property in Stratford, was involved in several lawsuits with his neighbors, and died there in 1616, aged 52. We also know for a fact that during these same years, a man with a last name similar to Shakespeare worked as an actor on the London stage, eventually becoming co-owner of some of the theaters there. We also know for a fact that about the same time, a number of most excellent plays and poems were published in London under the name Shakespeare. We do not know for a fact that the landowner in Stratford and the actor in London with a similar last name were one and the same man. We do not know for a fact that either man had anything to do with the plays and poems. All we know is that these plays and poems have, in the past 400 years since their composition, come to be regarded as the pinnacle of Western culture. The works attributed to Shakespeare appear to have been written by a man or a woman who knew something about just about everything. They're filled with references to mythology and classic literature, games and sports, war and weapons of war, ships and sailing, the law and legal terminology, court etiquette, statesmanship, horticulture, music, astronomy, medicine, falconry, and, of course, theater. And there lies the problem. How could a farmer's son of uncertain schooling from an illiterate country village, a man of practically no account at all, wield such encyclopedic learning with so much eloquence and wit, so much wisdom and human understanding? For the first 150 years after his death, no one questioned the traditional history of the bard. Then, in the late 18th century, the Reverend James Wilcott, a distinguished scholar who lived just a few miles north of Stratford, decided to write a biography of the famous playwright. Now, Dr. Wilcott believed that a man as well educated as Shakespeare must have owned a fairly extensive library, despite the fact that not a single book or manuscript is mentioned in his will. Over the years, he speculated, some of these books must have found their way into some local collections. And so, the good Reverend Doctor scoured the English countryside, taking inventory of literally every bookshelf within 50 miles of Stratford. Not a single book from the library of William Shakespeare was found. Neither were there found any letters to, from, or about Shakespeare. Furthermore, no references to the folklore, local sayings, or distinctive dialect of the Stratford area could be found in any of Shakespeare's writings. After 4 years of painstaking research, Dr. Wilmot concluded, to his own dismay, that only one person contemporary with Shakespeare possessed the wide-ranging education and demonstrated expressive talent to compose those magnificent poems and plays. That man was the multilingual author, philosopher, and statesman, inventor of the scientific method, chancellor to the courts of Queen Elizabeth and King James I, Sir Francis Bacon. Dr. Wilmot never dared to publish his theory. But before his death, he confided it to a friend, James Cowell, who in 1805 repeated it to a meeting of the Ipswich Philosophical Society. The members of this illustrious society were suitably outraged, and the scandalous matter was quickly forgotten. Then, in 1857, a lady from Stratford, Connecticut, published a book called The Philosophy of the Plays of Shakespeare Unfolded. In this book, Miss Delia Bacon, no relation to Francis, claimed that the works of Shakespeare were written by a secret cabal of British nobility, including Sir Walter Raleigh and for Sir Philip Sidney, as well as Sir Francis Bacon. Delia Bacon's book electrified the world of letters. Battle lines were drawn between the orthodox Stratfordians and the heretical Baconians. Literary societies and scholarly journals were formed to debate the evidence. Hundreds of pamphlets, newspaper articles, and essays were published defending each side and ridiculing the opposition with that self-aggrandizing viciousness peculiar to tenured academics. Armed with her explosive book, Delia Bacon journeyed to Stratford, England, and unbelievably obtained official permission to open Shakespeare's grave. However, when the moment came to actually lift the stone, Delia's self-doubt precipitated a catastrophic nervous breakdown. She died penniless in a madhouse. Then, around 1888, things began to get a little bit out of hand. U.S. Congressman Ignatius Donnelly of Minnesota became interested in the Shakespeare controversy. One day, browsing through his facsimile copy of the first folio of 1623, he noticed that the word Bacon appeared on page 53 of the histories and also on page 53 of the comedies. He also noted that Sir Francis Bacon had written extensively on the subject of cryptography. Donnelly began counting line and page numbers, adding and subtracting letters, drawing lines over sentences, circling words, and crossing them out. The result was a complex and virtually incomprehensible algorithm, which he claimed was invented by Bacon to hide secret messages in the first folio. The greatest Easter egg hunt in the history of Western civilization had begun. Here are just a couple of the silliest highlights. A doctor named Orville Owen of Detroit constructed a bizarre research tool he called the Wheel of Fortune. This wheel consisted of two giant wooden spools wrapped with a strip of canvas 2 feet wide and 1,000 feet long. Onto this canvas, he glued the separate pages of the complete works of Bacon, Shakespeare, Marlowe, Greene, Peele, and Spencer, along with Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy. By cranking the spools back and forth, Dr. Owen could quickly zip across the pages in search of clues and cross-references. Employing his team of secretaries and stenographers, Owen claimed to have discovered a complete alternative history of Elizabethan England, as well as several entirely new Shakespeare plays and sonnets. For a sample, listen to this hidden verse, penned by the mighty bard himself, which inspired Dr. Owen to build his Wheel of Fortune. Ready? Take your knife and cut all our books asunder and set the leaves on a great firm wheel which rolls and rolls, and turning the fickle rolling wheel, throw your eyes upon Fortune, that goddess blind, that stands upon a spherical stone that turning and inconstant rolls in restless variation. After publishing 5 thick volumes of this drivel, Owen announced the discovery of an anagram indicating that Bacon's original manuscripts were buried near Chepstow Castle on the River Wye. Owen spent the next 15 years and tens of thousands of dollars excavating the bed of the river with boat crews and high explosives. He died before anything was found. One more example, quick one this time. A fellow named Arnsberg wrote an entire book based on an analysis of the significance of a suspicious crack in the tomb of Bacon's mother. A ray of sanity finally appeared in 1957. To those of you familiar with the science of cryptography, the name of William Friedman requires very little introduction. During World War II, Colonel Friedman was the head of the U.S. Army's Cryptoanalytic Bureau. He is personally credited with cracking the Japanese Empire's most sensitive military cipher. After the war, the Colonel decided to apply his vast expertise to the study of the Shakespeare ciphers. He interviewed several of the experts in the field and prepared a detailed scientific analysis, which he published under the title, The Shakespeare Ciphers Examined. His conclusion? In a word, bunk. According to the standards of cryptologic science, not one of the hidden messages purportedly discovered in Shakespeare's works was plausible. The rules used to extract these messages from the texts were non-rigorous, widely subjective, and unrepeatable by anyone except the original decipherer. Now, the people involved were not being dishonest. They were channeling their preconceptions. They were trapped in a labyrinth of delusion, mining order out of chaos. To quote the bard, anglers in a sea of darkness. Well, you would think that Friedman's cold and ruthless exposure would be enough to silence the heretics once and for all. Not a chance. The books and TV specials and doctoral dissertations keep right on coming. Now, I should point out here that the Shakespeare authorship issue is not only the prominence of cranks and weirdos. A substantial number of very respected authors and Shakespeareans have expressed serious doubts about the traditional provenance of the plays. This list includes Nathaniel Hawthorne, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, Henry James, Samuel Clemens, Sigmund Freud, Orson Welles, and Sir John Gielgud. Living skeptics include the artistic director of the New Globe Theater, Mark Rylance, Michael York, Derek Jacobi, Kenneth Branagh, and even that most revered and scholarly of contemporary Shakespearean actors, Keanu Reeves. The current leading candidate for the authorship, by the way, is Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford, a theory first proposed in 1920 by an English schoolmaster with the unfortunate name J. Thomas Looney. Not that the Baconians have given up by any means. At sirbacon.org, for example, you can buy t-shirts, videos, posters, and Francis Bacon phone cards. So what is it about Bach, the Bible, and the works of Shakespeare that inspire this intense scrutiny? Nobody's looking for acrostics in Chaucer or Keats. There are no hit CDs of the secret chorales in Wagner or Beethoven. For the answer to this question, we need to recognize the unique roles which the Bible and Shakespeare have played in the development of Western culture. No other single work of literature has influenced modern English more than the translation of the Holy Bible published in 1611 under the auspices of King James I. The King James Bible exemplifies the meaning of the word great. It has been called the noblest monument of English prose, the very greatest achievement of the English language. It has served as an inspiration to generations of poets, dramatists, musicians, politicians, and orators. Countless people have learned to read by repeating the phrases in the only volume their family possessed. Our constitutions and laws have been profoundly shaped by its cadences and imagery. But even the achievement of the King James Bible, compiled by a committee of 46 editors over the course of a decade, pales before the dazzling legacy of the Bard of Avon. The lowest estimate of Shakespeare's working vocabulary is 15,000 words, more than three times that of the King James Bible, and twice the size of his nearest competitor, John Milton. His poems and plays were written without the aid of a dictionary or a thesaurus. They didn't exist yet. It was all coming out of his head. When Shakespeare had a thought for which Elizabethan English had no word, he invented one. The Oxford English Dictionary lists hundreds of everyday words and phrases which make their first appearance in the pages of Shakespeare. Addiction, alligator, assassination, bedroom, critic, dawn, design, dialogue, employer, film, glow, gloomy, gossip, hint, hurry, investment, lonely, luggage, manager, switch, transcendence, wormhole, zany, torture, majestic, unreal. Hamlet alone contains 40 of these neologisms. Who today would have the audacity, this giddy exuberance of invention? Only one other English author even approaches Shakespeare's facility for coining new words. Sir Francis Bacon. In the modern era, the record holder is Lewis Carroll, who interestingly also happens to be the second most quoted author in English after Shakespeare. Every person in this room has been profoundly molded by the influence of the King James Bible and Shakespeare. Like it or not, all of us peer at the world through the lenses of these great books. They are the primary source documents of modern English thought, the style guides of our minds. Contemplating these dazzling jewels of wisdom and eloquence gives rise to an odd feeling, a rare, potent, and precious emotion with the potential to completely upset your life. A kind of madness, an emotional powerful enough to make a man leave his wife and family, forfeit career and reputation, lay down his possessions, and follow his heart without question. That sweet, sweet fusion of wonder and fear, irresistible attraction and soul-numbing dread known as awe. Awe is the grail of artistic achievement. No other human emotion possesses such raw, transformative power, and none is more difficult to evoke. Few and far between, indeed, are the works of man that qualify as truly awesome. It is awe that convinces a rabbi to spend a lifetime decoding Yahweh from the Pentateuch. It is awe that makes people think that Francis Bacon phone cards are a good idea. It was awe that drove poor Delia Bacon to her doom. Now please, don't come away from this lecture thinking that the key to awesome game designs is the installation of Easter eggs. Ordinary games with their contrived Easter eggs and cheap little cheat codes, I like that Battery of the Month Club. You have to trudge down to the back of the store to claim what you really came for. If superpowers and funny asides are what people really want, why not just give it to them? Is our imagination so impoverished that we have to resort to these marketing gimmicks to keep players interested in our games? Awesome things don't hold anything back. Awesome things are rich and generous. The treasure's right there. One afternoon, I was sitting alone in that old Radio Shack store. My boss had just gone out for something. An elderly woman walked through the front door. Now, like most of our customers, she was fairly shabbily dressed, probably on a fixed income. I assumed she was there for her free battery, but instead she placed a radio on the counter. Now, this radio came from the days when they boasted about the number of transistors on the inside. And it was completely wrapped in dirty white medical tape. The woman looked at me and asked in a soft voice, "Can you fix this?" Slowly, I unwrapped the medical tape, peeling away the layers until the back cover fell off, accompanied by a cloud of red dust. The interior of that radio was eaten away by years of battery leakage and corrosion. I looked at the radio, looked at the old woman, looked at the radio. Then I reached behind me, where the expensive alkaline batteries were hanging like prescription medicine, and removed a gleaming 9-volt cell from its gold blister pack. Then I pulled a brand new transistor radio out of a box, installed the alkaline, and helped the woman find her favorite station. No money changed hands. The woman left the store without a word. Awesome things are like that. Bach offers his students very specific insight into the source of awe. In addition to B-A-C-H, two other sets of initials are also associated with Bach's music. These initials are not hidden in the music. Instead, they are scrawled right across the top of his manuscripts for the whole world to see. The initials are S-D-G and J-J. SDG stands for the Latin phrase Soli Deo Gloria, to the glory of God alone. JJ stands for Jesu Juva, help me, Jesus. Johann Sebastian Bach wrote all of his masterpieces sub specie aeternitatis, under the aspect of eternity. He did not compose to please his sponsors or to win the approval of an audience. His work was his worship. Bach once wrote, quote, "Music should have no other aim and end than the glory of God and the recreation of the soul. Where this is not kept in mind, there is no true music, but only an infernal clamor and ranting." The name of the power that moves you is not important. What is important is that you are moved. The foundation of awe is awe itself. It is the foundation of religion. No other motivation can free you from the limits of personal achievement. Nothing else can teach you the art of flight. Computer games are nearly 30 years old now. The work of the first generation of game designers is nearly complete. But only a few words in our basic vocabulary have been established. A whole new dictionary is waiting to be coined. The slate is clean. Someday soon, perhaps even in our lifetime, a game design will appear that will flash across our culture like lightning. It will be easy to recognize. It will be generous, giddy with exuberant inventiveness. Scholars will pick it apart for decades, perhaps centuries. It will be something wonderful, something terrifying, something awful. A few years ago, I was invited to speak at a conference in London. My wife joined me, and we took a day off for some sightseeing. England's biggest tourist attraction is the city of London itself. As we were there already, we decided to visit England's second biggest tourist attraction, Stratford-upon-Avon. It was cold and rainy when we arrived. Luckily, most of the attractions are just a short walk from the train station. We visited Shakespeare's birthplace, a charming old house along the main street which attracts millions of pilgrims every year, despite the complete lack of any evidence that Shakespeare was born or lived anywhere near there. We went past the school where Shakespeare learned to read and write, although no documents prove his attendance. We visited Anne Hathaway's cottage, the rustic country farm where his wife spent her childhood, although no record shows anyone by that name ever lived there. Finally, we came to the one location undeniably associated with Shakespeare, Trinity Parish Church, on the banks of the River Avon, where he is buried. This beautiful church is approached by a long walkway between rows of ancient gravestones shaded by tall trees. The entrance door is surprisingly tiny. No photographs or video cameras are allowed inside. The interior is dark and quiet. Despite the presence of busloads of tourists, the atmosphere is hushed and respectful. A few people are seated in the pews, deep in prayer. An aisle leads up the center of the church. The left side of the altar is brightly illuminated. On the wall above is the famous bust of the bard, quill in hand, gazing serenely across the crowd of the faithful. And on the floor beneath, surrounded by bouquets of flowers, at the very spot where Delia Bacon lost her mind, the gravestone of William Shakespeare bears this dire warning: "Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the stones enclosed here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones." Every year, 3 million pilgrims arrive from every nation on earth to approach this stone and consider the likeness of a man whose work can only be described as awesome. By contrast, the right side of the altar is dark and featureless, of no apparent interest. Nobody of any consequence is buried there. The only thing to see is a wooden case of simple design, carved of dark oak. A plaque on the case identifies the book as a first edition of the King James Bible. Inside the case, sealed behind a thick sheet of glass, lies a large open book. A plaque on the case identifies the book as a first edition of the King James Bible, dated 1611, when Shakespeare was 46. Not many pilgrims visit this side of the altar. Most of those that do simply glance at the book, read the plaque, and move along. A few, more observant, note that the Bible happens to be open to a page in the Old Testament, the Book of Psalms, chapter 46. No explanation is given for this particular choice of pages, and for the initiated, none is needed. Warning: if you are of an inquisitive bent, if you are intrigued by English history or literature, if you value your peace of mind, close your ears now. In the year 1900, a scholar noticed something about the King James Version of Psalm 46. Something terrifying. Something wonderful. Omitting the terminal notation, the 46th word from the beginning of Psalm 46 is shake, and the 46th word from the end is spear. There are exactly two possibilities here. Either this is a monstrous, outrageous, apocalyptic coincidence of a kind found absolutely nowhere else in all of Elizabethan literature, or somebody very highly placed in the court of King James I is having a bit of fun. The earth revolves around the sun. Only one sun. has only one moon. The moon happens to be 800 times smaller than the sun. And the sun happens to be 800 times farther away. Both happen to occupy the same orbital plane, which means that every now and then, at long yet precisely predictable intervals, the lunar disk slides across the sun and just barely conceals it for a few wonderful, terrible minutes. The name of the power that moves you is not important. What is important is that you are moved. In June of 1977, a little man with divergent eyes and a talent for mischief ascended a hilltop in the village of Ampthill. At the summit of this hill is a tall, slender cross, a memorial to Catherine of Aragon, wife of Henry VIII. The sun, high in the south, cast the shadow of the cross across the grass on the hillside. At exactly 12 noon, the man removed from his pocket a bar magnet 6 inches long. He turned the magnet so that the North Pole was facing south and buried it under the shadow of the cross. 2 years later, the night before the publication of his first book, that man returned to the hillside. This time in the dead of night. He used a compass to locate the magnet he had buried 2 years previously. In that same place, he carefully dug a hole in the ground and placed inside a ceramic casket inscribed with the following words: I am the keeper of the jewel of masquerade, waiting for you. For eternity. If you're quiet here for just a moment, you'll hear those last four notes of Bach's Art of Fugue. Thank you for coming. Thank you.